We kind of left off last week in the middle of the Absalom narrative, probably end sometime this week in the middle of the Absalom narrative. So we should probably have 3 weeks in the narrative and then maybe hopefully 1 week in the discussion questions. We'll kind of see how that goes. But kind of just got introduced to Absalom. Saw that Absalom was the son of David, but also of a Gentile princess who David took during the early years of his reign as king. Before Israel was united underneath the single banner, Israel and Judah of David. Remember, he had 7 years where he reigned in Judah. And during that time, he took a wife from the Gentile kingdom. And Absalom was one of the children from that relationship. Another was Tamar. And we spent a little bit of time looking at Tamar and her story, and particularly Amnon's sin against Tamar as he called her in and then sexually assaulted her, and how the consequences of that. And then Absalom's response to that, Tamar being his sister, okay, how he plotted and planned for 2 years, and after seeing that David was going to do nothing, we set up a plan to throw a feast whenever he gathered his people together to shear some sheep. His brothers came, he got Amnon drunk, and then he had Amnon killed, okay, and all of the other brothers fled. After that, after having killed his brother, he goes back to his maternal grandfather's place in Geshur, and he lays low there for 3 years. Okay, and kind of where we left off last week was David allowing that time to pass. He mourned over the death of Amnon, his son, crown prince, but time passed and healed that wound, and it said that he began to miss Absalom. Okay, and so his heart is for Absalom, his desire is for Absalom, and we kind of talked a little bit about Joab, how Joab's going to facilitate a meeting between Absalom and David, and how that's going to ultimately come to pass in the chapters ahead. So, chapter 14 of 2 Samuel, look just there at the first verse. Now Joab the son of Zeruiah knew that the king's heart went out to Absalom, and Joab's going to then put forth a plan by which he's going to bring Absalom back. So he concocts this plan, borrowing from who? It seems like in the manner that he does this. Who does he borrow from as far as his method in getting David to open his eyes and see that Absalom needs to return? Who's that? Okay. Yes, Joab was the one that implemented the plan, but he's going to do so by means of a story. And back in chapter 12, it was Nathan who came and told a parable to David to help him open his eyes and see beyond the reality of his sin with Bathsheba. He tells the parable of the rich man and the shepherd and the sheep, and how he takes the poor man's lamb. And David's finally able to see what he needs to do. His eyes are open. And Joab's going to use a similar approach here. Dave, did you want to make a comment? Okay, you're just going to make that observation? Well, I should let you say it. Okay, so he has this old woman comes, and she comes seeking the king's advice, if you will. Now, Joab's kind of given her the words that she's to say. So she's an older woman, and she's fabricating this story. She was a well-known woman, comes to David, and she says, "My husband's died. I'm a widow. I had two sons. One day as my sons were out in the field working, one of them killed the other. And now, after people have found out about it, they're crying out for justice, that the one son that I have left needs to be put to death." And she says, "If he's put to death, then I'm going to have no one left. There will be no one to perpetuate my husband's name." Okay, so she comes to David for the plea of mercy in hopes that he will set free the one, liberate the one who was to be put to death for killing his brother, so that she would be able to have a heritage and raise up a heritage for her husband. Okay, so David, upon hearing that, he sees through immediately what she's trying to do, knowing this is an Absalom-Amnon parallel. He sees through that, and he says, "I'm going to ask you something. You tell me the truth." She says, "Okay." He said, "Did Joab put you up to this?" She says, "Yes, Joab put me up to this." So Joab's plan was discovered, but at the same time, Joab's plan was successful. Jump down to verse 21 of 2 Samuel 14, and we kind of see what happens here after this transpires between this old woman and David. Then the king said to Joab, "Behold, now I grant this. Go bring back the young man Absalom." And Joab fell on his face to the ground and paid homage and blessed the king. And Joab said, "Today your servant knows that I have found favor in your sight, my lord the king, in that the king has granted this request of his servant." So Joab arose and went to Geshur and brought Absalom to Jerusalem. And the king said, "Let him dwell apart in his own house. He is not to come into my presence." So So Absalom lived apart in his own house and did not come into the king's presence. So we kind of see here this bringing back, if you will, Absalom, who had been hiding away in Geshur for 3 years. He's brought back to the city of Jerusalem. Why do you think David refuses to see him? That's kind of a thought I had as I was reading through this. Why do you think David says he can come home, but I don't want to see him? He obviously loves him, so why does he keep him at arm's length? Okay, maybe afraid. I hadn't thought about that. I suppose it's possible. Cole?
Maybe the confrontation would force him to enact justice, invoke justice for him, the justice he knows that he should do according to his son's need. Yeah. But, you know, by not seeing him, he can put that behind, you know, in the back of his mind.
Yeah. That's kind of where I was leaning, that if he brings Absalom back, you can't just overlook it, right? Something's got to be done. We're going to see a confrontation later on. But not at this point. So it seems to me David's kind of trying to balance justice and mercy, doesn't it? Kind of keep him far enough away where he doesn't have to deal with it, but he does allow him to come home. Dad?
I was going to say slap him on the wrist.
Okay.
Which is pretty much how he dealt with all his children.
Right, right.
That way he can say, well, I didn't let it go unpunished.
Yeah, I suppose you could say that. And it isn't much more than a slap on the wrist. As you pointed out, this is historically how he's behaved with his children. Kind of like with the whole Amnon-Tamar deal, you know, after what he does to his sister. David was very angry, but he didn't do anything about it, okay? He might have expressed his displeasure, if that much, with Amnon, but he deals too gently sometimes with his children and just allows things to go that should be punished. That's a good point. I hadn't thought of that. Very possible. Okay, the Enduring Word commentary makes a wise observation here. Let me just share with you what it says. It says, David was overindulgent with his sons in the past, as when he got angry but did nothing against Amnon, what Dad was talking about. Now David is too harsh with Absalom, refusing to see him after he has been exiled in Geshur for 3 years. When parents don't discipline properly from the beginning, they tend to overcompensate in the name of toughness, and this provokes the child to wrath and makes the parent-child relationship worse. So it may be that David's trying to kind of overcompensate by keeping Absalom away. You know, he's so angry, I'm just not going to see him. Okay, so he keeps him away and doesn't allow him to come into his presence. And as we're going to see, the situation is just going to go from bad to worse with Absalom and David. Miss Johnny? Yeah. Okay. He may not have known what to do, and so kind of just bringing him back kind of semi-reconciles the relationship. Meanwhile, he kind of sees how it's going to play out. I hadn't thought of that. That's good. All right, let's read a little further in the narrative, down in verse 25 of 2 Samuel 14. Okay. Now in all of Israel, there was no one so much to be praised for his handsome appearance as Absalom. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no blemish in him. And when he cut the hair of his head, for at the end of every year he used to cut it when it was heavy on him, he cut it, and he weighed the hair of his head, 200 shekels by the king's weight. There were born to Absalom 3 sons and 1 daughter whose name was Tamar, and she was a beautiful woman. So the only significance of this passage is to make note of one of the things that Absalom is well known for, that is his handsome appearance. And while we might perceive this to be complimentary, you know, through the lens of cultural society today, that's about the best compliment somebody could get, right? Such and such was a handsome person, such and such was a beautiful young lady. Maybe that's the peak of the compliment in regard to society today. But understand, this is not a divine compliment on Absalom's appearance by any means. Can you think of another king who was praised for his appearance? Who? I heard somebody say, yeah, Saul. Okay, that's one of the things that was observed about Saul. It says Saul was a head taller than all of the other men. Saul looked the part of a natural leader. Okay, and we know how he turned out to be. And you'll remember, even after Samuel was sent to the house of Jesse, after Saul's disobedience in offering the burnt offering before the battle, and then his refusal to destroy the Amalekites like he was commanded, the Lord says to Samuel, go to the house of Jesse, and you're going to anoint a new king, a man after my own heart. And Samuel goes to the house of Jesse, and Jesse's oldest son, Eliab, comes out. And Samuel looks at him and says, wow, there's the natural born leader. He's tall, dark, and handsome. Same as Saul was, who was obviously rejected by God and who had no character. And then the Lord comes to Samuel and says, don't look at the outside. The Lord doesn't look at the outside. The Lord looks at the heart. Okay, and so Samuel kind of fell into the trap that so oftentimes we do, that is judging a book by its cover. And so what God makes clear is that outward appearance is not the beauty that he seeks with people. And I'm really glad we didn't get to this part last week, seeing as it would have really coincided a little too much for my taste with last week's sermon. But, you know, God doesn't count so much on outward beauty. He seeks inward beauty within people. I, for one, take very great solace in that fact. But in 1 Peter 3:3-4, Peter writes, "Let not your adorning be external, the braiding of hair, the putting on of jewelry, or the clothing you wear." So much of what we give our time and attention and focus to, Peter says, don't let that be the focus. "However, let your adorning be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is precious in the sight of God." Okay, and that's the kind of beauty we should be seeking to develop. And obviously, as we talked about last week, that's not to say we should shun all things physical. However, we've got to keep those things in perspective. And this commentary on Saul, this commentary on Absalom, handsome guys. Well, we see how that plays out. Matthew Henry makes a wise comment here. He says, nothing is said of Absalom's wisdom and piety. All here said of him is that he was very handsome, a poor commendation for a man that had nothing else in him valuable. Many a polluted, deformed soul dwells in a fair and comely body. And we read that he had a very fine head of hair. It was a burden for him, but he would not cut it as long as he could bear the weight. That which feeds and gratifies pride is not complained of, though uneasy. May the Lord grant us the beauty of holiness and the adorning of a meek and quiet spirit. And if you think about it, what was Saul's downfall? One thing, what was Saul's downfall? Well, I say it's his pride. Saul's pride, and you see it manifesting particularly as he is rejected and he continues to rebel against God. God says, "I've chosen a new man," and Saul says, "No." And he tries to kill the one that God is going to replace him with. Saul's pride seems to be largely, to me, his downfall anyway. You may say, yes, he was fearful, and yes, he was a coward, and other things as well. But much of it comes down to, I think, Saul's pride. And Absalom, handsome in appearance, particularly regarding his great man of hair, was a source of pride. And if you know how this story ends, then you know that the source of pride isn't going to work out well for Absalom. Pride comes before a fall. And one more part in detail. All throughout the kingdom, did you notice that? All throughout the kingdom, everybody talked about how handsome Absalom was. David's getting old. And as you kind of read through this, I think we're supposed to pick up on the fact that maybe the people are looking for a new king. Maybe the people want a change of leadership. Handsome Absalom, he seems to fit the bill. All right, question number 4. How long did Absalom live in Jerusalem before he finally was reunited with his father?
2 years.
2 years. 2 Samuel 14, verse 28. We can read there. So Absalom lived 2 full years in Jerusalem without coming into the king's presence. Okay. It's quite possible that more than just not being able to come into the presence of the king, yet kind of as I read the narrative, what it seems to me is almost like Absalom's under house arrest. You know, he's confined maybe to his home and to his property. The reason I say that is because Absalom's going to want to have this conversation with Joab a little bit later on. David's general, who stands in the presence of the king, he wants to get word to David, and so he's going to try to get a hold of Joab. He can't do it. And so he calls Joab twice, and rather than going out and chasing him down, which you would think if he was a free man, well, he'd just ride and he'd find Joab and give Joab the message. But he doesn't. He tries to call for him twice. Joab doesn't come. So for 2 years, Absalom lives in Jerusalem, partially but not fully reconciled to his father. And you can imagine how this is going to create bitterness in his heart. Amnon has raped Absalom's sister, and all David did was get angry. Absalom, who is at least right in his own mind, although he isn't truly right according to God's standard of truth and justice, Absalom avenges his sister, and David won't let him even come into his presence. So you can probably appreciate how Absalom sees this as a complete and utter double standard. And you can imagine how there's going to be seeds of bitterness that are growing within his heart. And finally, Absalom can't take it anymore. He calls Joab to intercede on his behalf, and Joab won't come, just ignores him. He calls Joab again, Joab won't come. Finally, he says, "I'm going to get Joab's attention." Absalom's got this barley field, and Joab's got this barley field next to it. And so what Absalom does, he sets fire to Joab's barley field. You start messing with a man's money, you'll quickly get his attention. Joab finally shows up and says, "Hey man, what do you think you're doing?" Dad, you want to comment real quick?
Lord,
Okay. Well, I was just kind of bringing us along in the narrative. So he burns Joab's field down. Joab comes to see him, and Absalom tells him, "I want you to intercede on my behalf with my father. I know you're with David. I want you to carry him a message." Okay. This partial reconciliation was terrible, and I don't know if Absalom was showboating or if he truly believed this to be true, but so sincere he seems in the rightness of his actions in killing Amnon, he says, "If there is guilt in me, let me be put to death." Okay? And so, I don't know if he's just kind of being dramatic or if he truly believes he was right to do what he did to his brother. Certainly, we can understand where Absalom's coming from. I'm sure we can all do that. But in accordance with the law of God, you know, that there are certain penalties and certain laws that must be followed. And it seems like Absalom was outside the bounds of that, especially to take personal vengeance. He should have sought vengeance from the king, justice from the king, but to take justice into his own hands and kill his brother, that certainly was wrong. Personal vengeance is not vindicated. Tommy?
Well, underneath the old law, personal vengeance was vindicated because they could, if somebody was murdered or killed or assaulted unwillingly, the family members had a right to go chase them down. They didn't make it to a city of refuge.
Yeah, but Amnon didn't kill Tamar.
No, but he forced her.
Yes.
And underneath the old law, if a woman was forced, a man could be killed.
There were three situations, I think, that are described, Tommy, and I'll have to look into this more specifically. I know if it was an adulterous relationship, as in a man took a woman who was another man's wife, then that was murder on the basis of adultery. Or betrothed, I think that kind of fits in there as well. But, and I'll have to double check my details, or maybe someone here can find it. I think if a man did that to a virgin, that he was then commanded to marry her. Like I said, I'll have to look at the details of that, but I believe in accordance with the old law, that was the situation. If a man forced a woman, that he had to then marry her. Could be wrong on that. There was also another situation where, if it seemed to be a mutual kind of thing, the woman didn't scream out, didn't try to get away, and they were found out, then she was to be put to death along with the man. And if she did, then the man alone was guilty. I'll have to double check on that, but I do believe for Amnon's circumstances that the penalty according to the law was not death. But I'll have to double check that. Anybody here want to validate that or correct that? Right. We talked about that a little bit. But just according to the law, it was a sticky situation. And as to the law itself, how David would have adjudicated on that, it's kind of very unique because of their relationship, but also because of what Amnon did. So, anyway, we'll have to, Tommy, we can follow that up maybe a little more private conversation. Dad?
Mm-hmm. And this situation with being exiled, he's lucky to be alive. The penalty for murder was death. He did better than the king's son.
Right.
And the fact that David didn't ever put death, he ought to be thankful that David brought it back to live. But he's been spoiled. He knows David's not going to kill him now.
Mm-hmm.
So now he's playing on it. I think he's his man from asking if I've been found guilty, then let's see. He knows he's been guilty.
Yeah.
He knows he deserves to be guilty. He knows daddy's not
going to
do
anything. So he may just be showboating.
And his whole character is just me. Mm-hmm. Through his life.
Yeah. Yeah. Certainly. And I think that's one of the things that's being brought out here by his appearance being described as quite the handsome fella. It's a play on his pride. And it's his pride that's going to be his downfall as well. All right. So, all of that to say, he gets the message to Joab. Joab goes to David. David calls Absalom. And after putting on this, well, we can just read that last little bit there. Let me see where it's at. All right, look at verse 33 of 2 Samuel 14. Then Joab went to the king and told him, and he summoned Absalom. So he came to the king and bowed himself on his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom. So 5 years apart, 3 years in Geshur, 2 years in Jerusalem. He hasn't seen his father. And finally, Joab carries the message to David, and David and Absalom are able to reconcile. Let me just take a moment here to comment. The old law was unique to a culture that is so far removed from ours. It's hard for us sometimes to grasp the way things were, the way they were. We live in a society where largely, you know, peace and order abounds, and so much of the old law sounds very graphic and maybe even unfair in our eyes. However, we have to realize and understand this was a completely different world in which the people lived. And, you know, one of the charges oftentimes brought against Christianity is, you know, women are demeaned. And you just read through the Bible, and that's just not what you see. What God does throughout Scripture is God elevates and God honors women. Okay, you can just read time after time after time where, you know, you think of Mary, you know, how Scripture talks about, you know, God uses woman to bring forth the Savior into the world. And then I think of Mary Magdalene, who was the first one to see the risen Lord. And, you know, the women were, in a sense, the first preachers of the gospel when he told the women, you know, who were at the cross, go and tell my apostles, you know, what's happened. Tell them that I'm risen, okay? And so you have the command to husbands, second in Ephesians 5:25, husbands, love your wife. How much love your wife? Even as Christ loved the church and gave himself for her. Husbands, dwell with your wives in an understanding way. Okay, and so people will take and they'll twist certain things, and then they'll, you know, look at them and say, well, you know, Christianity is misogynistic and all of these other things, but the opposite is true. Jesus came to liberate. In fact, you see Jesus liberating slavery. I mean, that's what the Bible does. The principles and precepts of Christianity, of love and of service and compassion and kindness, you know, they do away with those barriers that divide. And such it does also with women and God's instruction for them to be treated specially, cared for, loved by their husbands, and, you know, their part in God's work of salvation and his use of redemption. Tommy?
Yeah, just reference on that point that I was talking about. If you look at Leviticus chapter 20, verse 17, man shall take his sister, his father's daughter, or his mother's daughter, and see their next man, it is a wicked thing, and they shall be cut off in the sign of their people. He hath uncovered his sticks.
I see what you're saying there. That is indeed what it says. If that being the case, since they shared a father, that was a sin punishable by death. As for the application of that, you know, well, I think the whole sense of this is, you know, was Absalom right? Was he justified, you know, in what he did to Amnon? That I would have questions of. You're right, he should have been. The penalty was death for what Amnon did. But what should Absalom have been the one who brought that about? I'll have to look at how that balances with the avenger of blood. I am aware of that, the idea that a man can, you know, track down someone who's killed a relative. But it's one thing for Absalom to be, for Amnon to be put to death, but for Absalom to be the one to do that, you know, I'd have to look into that and see how those passages kind of line up. But you are right. The penalty for what Amnon did should have been death. He should have been put to death. And David didn't abide by the law in that regard. Doesn't seem to abide by the law in regard to Absalom either. So, but thank you for bringing that and bringing some clarification on that. All right. Question number 5: how did Absalom steal the hearts of the men of Israel? Okay, let's read that. He kind of put himself in a favorable position, made him look good, sold himself. Let's just read that real quick. 2 Samuel 15, 1 through 6. So he's been reconciled to David. After this, Absalom got himself a chariot and horses and 50 men to run before him. And Absalom used to rise early and stand before the way of the gate. And when any man had a dispute to come before the king for judgment, Absalom would call to him and say, "From what city are you?" And when he said, "You're servant of such and such a tribe in Israel," Absalom would say to him, "See, your claims are good and right, but there is no man designated by the king to hear you." Then Absalom would say, "Oh, that I were a judge in the land. Then every man with a dispute or cause might come to me, and I would give him justice." And whenever a man came near to pay homage to him, he would put out his hand, take hold of him, and kiss him. Thus Absalom did to all of Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. Okay, so Absalom is a natural politician. For one, he understands the importance of appearance. He gets a chariot and 50 men to run before him. It's not for getting around. This is not a means of transportation. This is all about building a public image. Okay. He already looks the part of a king. He, I believe, next to Amnon, with Amnon out of the picture, Absalom is crown prince. And so he's the envy of every man in the kingdom. And then to ingratiate himself to all of the people, he kind of stands at the gate before the people come to Jerusalem. He says, "Why are you here? Where are you from? Why are you here?" He's a typical politician. He's shaking hands, kissing babies, that kind of thing. You know, and the person with the complaint who's seeking justice from the king, they'll say, "Well, this is my issue. Okay, it wasn't handled in smaller court, if you will, favorably. So I brought this issue to the king." And Absalom just kind of says, "Well, you know, there's nobody here that can really make a judgment on that. If I were in position, if I had the authority, I would rule in your favor." He tells people what they want to hear. He kind of sets himself in between David. He makes himself look good. Not even hearing their claim, "Behold, your claim is right and good." And then he bemoans the fact that there's no one to rule in their favor. Okay, so anytime someone came near to Absalom, he'd lift them up, and they went to bow down. He'd lift them up, throw his arms around them, and kiss them, which was a gesture of friendship and respect. And so Absalom is all of this. He's trying to build rapport with the people. And it works, because we're told there in verse 6 that Absalom stole the hearts of the people of Israel. Okay.
Zach, there's a lot back to politicians nowadays. Sort of what we see when politicians promising you everything for the vote.
Yeah.
It's been going on since, at least since back that far, probably since the beginning of time.
Yeah, Well, I'm sure we probably have other examples of scripture, but he kind of sets before us kind of your prototypical way to win favor with the people, doesn't he? Yeah. You know, tell them what they want to hear, emphasize the appearance of things. You know, Absalom's running around in his chariot with 50 men running before him. He must be somebody special. And tell them, "Hey, you know, you're right, you're good. If I could, I'd give you what you wanted." You know, so if only people would read the rest of the story and see how it ends for old Absalom, then maybe they go about things in a different manner, right? They wouldn't make promises that they couldn't keep. All right, comments or questions up to this point?
I think you see the David's lack of skill. Because there's no doubt David knew this was happening. Absalom's not hiding. You know, there's advisors and people who tell David, Absalom's out there making promises to all the people and show up around. David knew this. They're not like kings don't know. But all the chance that he did, though, he still chose not to do anything about it.
Yeah.
But even when Absalom tries to make a kingdom by force, he doesn't resist. He gives up with it.
I think he realized, though, he was in a position where he could fight back, where he could withstand them. As to whether he knew, he had to know something was going on. You know, just what he knew, whether he knew that this was going to end in a coup, this was Absalom's play for the throne, or maybe he was thinking, well, this is Absalom kind of preparing himself, grooming himself to step into the position. Maybe he thought it was good that Absalom was demonstrating some of the political skills, if you will. What gets me is I don't see how Joab missed it. You know, Joab would do anything to protect David and in the best interest of Israel. And so that's the only thing that makes me think maybe it wasn't as obvious to the king as he thought, because I feel like Joab would have overrode David's desire to keep peace with Absalom, to settle the situation, seeing as he's going to do that ultimately anyway. So, all right, we'll pick up with question 6 next week and kind of try to finish our narrative and get through to our discussion questions. So.